those homes.
Turn to 1 Kings 14, 25 to 28. Let me give a little background before we start reading. Rehoboam is the son of Solomon and the grandson of David. Rehoboam inherits from his father a great and rich kingdom and an unhappy populace who have been taxed too hard. So when he went to be made finally king of Israel, the people came to him and said, "Lower taxes, please." So he went to his father's old advisors and said, "What should I do?" And the old advisors said, "Say whatever the people want to hear, and when you've really got power, you can do what you want." Then he went to the young advisors. And the advisors who had grown up with him said, "Show him who's boss right now." Well, Rehoboam took the second advice, which was unusually stupid, and the Bible says he took this advice because God intended to rip 10 tribes out of his control. So Rehoboam did this. The northern tribes rebelled under the leadership of Jeroboam. God hasn't always made it easy to keep people straight. There's Elijah and Elisha. There's Jeroboam and Rehoboam. So Jeroboam leads a rebellion successfully against Rehoboam. And Jeroboam had been hiding out in Egypt after he ran away from Solomon. Great powers always give refuge to people out of power in the neighboring powers. So he's down there so that Egypt can make trouble with him the moment there's an opportunity. And the moment Solomon died, Egypt sent Jeroboam right back to Israel to make trouble. It was very successful. And now what was once a strong kingdom is now divided. And we come to these verses. "It happened in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. And he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the gold shields which Solomon had made. Then King Rehoboam made bronze shields in their place and committed them to the hands of the captains of the guard who guarded the doorway of the king's house. And whenever the king entered the house of the Lord, the guards carried them, then brought them back into the guard room." Now you understand that neither gold shields nor bronze shields are useful for anything in fighting. All right. The purpose of the gold shields is to show the overwhelming wealth and glory of the kingdom. And what Rehoboam did is he simply replaced them with bronze, way, way less valuable than gold. It's an alloy of copper and something else. Zinc, I think?
Tin.
Alloy of copper and tin. Now, I have something that looks almost like bronze. You wonder why? He used this morning. Here it is. This is not bronze, it's brass, and it's even less valuable than bronze. But it's about the same color, which is why people sometimes get them mixed up. And picture this if it were made all of gold. First of all, of course, I wouldn't be holding it like this. I'd be holding it like this. And second, it would be, well, just be gloriously beautiful, which this is not. Now, our topic this evening is fake families. The point of the reading is, when you lose the really valuable thing, you substitute something else for it. And the substitute often has some value, but it's not the same as the real thing. Now, in order to talk about fake families, we have to know what a non-fake family looks like. How many of you belong to non-fake families? I think that's mostly true. You will hear, I don't know why you're laughing, you will hear a lot of people today say that the most oppressive thing in our country is the patriarchal nuclear family. Which of course sounds like something about ready to explode. It's nuclear. And there is a whole body of university research which ordinarily nobody could possibly believe unless they were highly educated, which indicates that the nuclear family is some weird, strange, oppressive Western imposition on people. We need to get rid of it in order to be free. So I want to start with the origin of human society. Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel. What does that sound like? Nuclear family. It's nucleus. I prefer the word nucleus rather than nuclear. It's the nucleus to a family. When things go badly and God has to restart things, all the way through the Bible, he restarts from a family nucleus. After the flood, there's Mr. Noah, Mrs. Noah, their three sons, Mrs. Shem, Mrs. Ham, and Mrs. Japheth, and they have children, and you start from the nucleus of the family. When God called Abraham, it was Abraham, and who was with him? Wife, Sarah. Now, the big problem in their case was having their first kid. But in the end, they do. It's a father, mother, child family. When Israel is in Egypt, God plans their salvation through Amram and Jochebed from the tribe of Levi having the courage to go ahead and have another child, even though if it were a boy, he'd be destined to be thrown into the Nile River. Nucleus of the family. When Israel was in bad shape at the end of the period of the judges, how about Samuel? He comes from a father, mother, mother family. Those tended to be not as stable or happy as the father-mother family, but father, he's not the son of both mothers. Although, one of the trouble is, you probably have to answer to both mothers. I think you all would have hated to grow up in a family where dad had two wives. The Quran says four is the maximum. David. He is the great-grandson of Boaz and Ruth. And then you can follow the family down. He's from a fairly big family. He's the youngest son, and there were some sisters as well, and Jesse's family. Jesus. Where does God intend for Jesus to grow up? A mother, father, child, family. The next time you read or hear anybody saying, the nuclear family is a Western patriarchal institution which needs to be destroyed, you know this is utter nonsense. Now, what do you get in a family? This is your normal family. Well, I'm going to name four things that are part of most family nucleuses through most of history. One, most of the time, most of the work is done inside the family. In 1790, 90% of Americans were on family farms. The work was done by father, mother, and children. And the children started to work really young. But they worked. And the more children you had, the more stuff you could do. You get protection. The more sons you have, the more you can strut around. And if you have a bunch of brothers, well, good. So there's a guy in our church with a family of eight, and some guy was bothering a sister. There were five brothers. So the three brothers found the guy and said, we are her brothers. There are two more of us. Leave her alone. He did. That's all they had to do. So you get protection. You have children, work, protection, and you also have memory. Most people's memories really begin with what they learn in their family. Some families have a lot of memory about previous generations. Some would rather hide the gambler in great Uncle George. But you'd have a lot of memory. And usually the memory in a family intersects with the memory of both church and state. So in my family, for example, I grew up with some stories connected both with the church and with the country. Some which cut totally against the expected truths that you would get from the textbooks. So, for example, this is a family story. My great-grandfather, David Burt Wilson, goes right from Penn Med School into the a Union prisoner of war camp. Cut off enough legs and arms, he didn't want to continue doing that, so he ended up doing something else. But within the family comes down a report from this absolutely staunch abolition family that he found the Southern officers far more gentlemanly than the Northern officers. That's the report. So you get these stories within the family, and they're connected to the nation, they're connected to the church, so your memory that anchors you so that you are less vulnerable to the latest thing from the university, or the latest thing from TikTok, or the latest thing from wherever, you say, wait a minute, I know this. Now, I like the idea of father, mother, children as nucleus, because then you can have a cloud of electrons around it. And there's quite a cloud of electrons around some families. There is sometimes, and often through most history, a household. At the center of a household is a... Now, you can maybe remember the picture of a household from the movie The Wizard of Oz. At the end, Dorothy gets back to Kansas. We leave the color behind and go back to the black and white. And there are the three people that were in Oz. And they are working there with for her mother, and her mother's a widow, working there. So you have a household, father, mother, children, and hired hands. You also have other generations, grandparents. In fact, grandparents have often been so much part of family life that there's an old tradition of alternate generations being allied together against the poor one in the middle. So you have the grandparents allied with the grandchildren against the children slash parents. The purpose of grandparents is to help out the parents and indulge the grandchildren. And you can indulge as long as you just do the grandparent thing. At one point, we had a number of children from a certain family that I won't name. And I came home on day two. They were here for quite a while. And Grandma had disappeared. And Mom had reappeared. Right there. Because you can't afford to be grandparenty if you've got them all the time. Now, there's a lot more you get from the grandparents, but and then you've got uncles, aunts, cousins, and in some society, the more uncles, aunts, and cousins you've got, the more social power you've got. So, for example, last time we were in Larnaca, I was getting straight that my uncle's wife was from the Michalides family, and one of the Michalides family was now the assistant mayor of Larnaca. And I actually knew, having been there long enough, that if I needed to go to the assistant mayor and get help, I would go and I would say, I am the nephew of Sinia Michalides, Edgar, and can I talk with you? And he would almost certainly say, yes. In fact, in the Greek world, and also in the Turkish world, the Kurdish world, the Arabic world, and most of the Balkan world, you've got a kin network that goes to all of the relatives of the people married into your family. So, for example, in Greek, I have a relative, Stimpetherosmo, Evniki's father. I've got a Stimpethera, her mother. And through them, I've got all their other relatives. So, when people talk about, well, the nuclear family is something special, I think what they have in mind is, in some societies, you've got this much wider spread cloud of electrons around the family, but the nucleus has always been the same, father, mother, children. Now, I want to talk about families that are damaged families. They're still families, but they're damaged. One thing that can damage a family is missing members. I grew up in a family. My father died when I was 6, so I grew up with my mother and her sister. We would refer to our parents, and then our friends from grade school would come over to the house and be a little bit perplexed. I learned recently from an old friend of mine that I was actually known as the boy without a father. Drexel Hill was so stable in those days, every family was father, mother, child, and I was unusual. I was the boy without a father. That was a damaged family. Would I have preferred a father, mother family? Of course. Wasn't God's plan for us. Then there is, actually worse, divorce. Divorce just rips apart the one flesh that God has made, and the church has always been quite definite that divorce is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Malachi, God says, I hate divorce. I just hate it. Mm-hmm. So the Confession of Faith has a very narrow band of reasons to justify saying goodbye to your spouse. Adultery, and they're gone and missing, and you can't find them, and nobody can make them come home. That's it. And, of course, a lot of people hear that, and if they're married and the house is not happy, they're looking for every which way for some way to get out of this unhappy marriage. But when you do that, things get worse for the children. Now, I'm old enough to know that when we adopted in this country no-fault divorce, started in California, started with Ronald Reagan, governor, signs it, no-fault divorce, the idea had long been there that if you're not really getting along too well, husband and wife, well, stay together for the sake of the children. And this got mocked every which way for the next 30 years. Why? Well, it's the same thing you hear today when you mask up children, keep them home, and don't let them see their friends and can't even see each other's faces. They're resilient. Actually, they're not so resilient. And I don't need to read that anymore. The evidence is so clear. No, they're not so resilient. That's really hard on children. Still a family. Usually ends up mother and the kids. Sometimes ends up ping pong. Sometimes ends up with neither of them wants a kid. I had a guy come into an Algebra 2 class about October. He explained he was with his mother. She didn't want him anymore, so now he was with his father. And then he came in February, and he had candy for everybody in the class and said, I'm going to a boarding school. My father doesn't want me either. That's often something along those lines. Happens too often with families damaged by divorce. And then you have actually something that is probably even more difficult. You have the single-parent family, which is a euphemism for mother-child family. And then you have children who never even knew their father. Don't know his name. My children, Alex and Adam, who teach at Upper Darby High School, have an increasing number of students who simply don't know their father's names. It's not just that the father is gone someplace, and they don't even know his names. It's just a mother-child family. And when things don't go well, life is really hard for just a mother-child family. Just look at the last few years. It's a damaged family. And then you have a family damaged when a child dies. So my son Adam and his wife Lisa have 4 children, 3 living. And it's always kind of hard to say that, but it's 4 living, 3 children. And there's a loss and an emptiness that goes on with that reality. Then you have what I would call a different kind of damaged family. I call these deformed families. The most frequent kind of deformed family in some parts of the world is the husband with 2 wives. It's really a family, but the relationships get quite complicated. So you have polygamy. In a few places, the anthropologists have dug up families, places where they have polyandry. I don't know what woman will want 2 husbands, but anyway, you get polyandry. And then you have what is way more common in our country. You have families that are damaged, or deformed rather, because the relationships that God has established in the family between husband, wife, and children are upended. I have known families where the husband had to jump and do what his wife said. The first one that I met was so severe this way, I came away and I said, I can't stand being around these people. Because she just absolutely ran everything. That's a deformed family. Here's another kind of deformed family. The children call the shots. Now, I dealt with a fair number of those families as a teacher, where the children somehow established the upper hand, and they're calling the shots in the house, and they've got the parents, or just one parent, running scared. Now, I'm not going to give a long exposition of Ephesians 5. There will be an explanation of Ephesians 5 in a future issue of A Little Strength. Look for it. But the Lord says, submitting to one another, wives as to their husbands, husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church, children, obey your parents. Parents, don't make life really hard for your kids. There's the relationship in the family. If that is deformed, then you have an unhappy family. And these families, and now these are another kind of damaged families, where all kinds of sin just takes place. Family full of anger, which sometimes leads to a family full of shouting, which sometimes has a family with physical violence between husband and wife. Sometimes the kids get beaten up. Sometimes there's just flat-out hatred where there should be love. Sometimes there are infidelities. And the children sense that when it's present. And you can have a sense of just how widespread is that actually in our country. Is just go to college, those of you the right age, and talk to your classmates when Christmas vacation comes. Do they want to go home? Or do they want to stay as far away from home as possible? They want to go home if home is a place of refuge, love, fun, kindness. They don't want to go home if home is a place of hatred, shouting, beating, and just all-around unhappiness. And I was surprised my freshman year, a long time ago now, to find a lot of my classmates just dreaded the idea of going home at Christmas time. And initially, I was just perplexed. I really loved going home. I was in a damaged family. My father was dead, but I loved my mother. I loved my Aunt Libby. I loved my brothers, and I was happy to go home. But that's not true of a lot of people. Now, where do the people come from who are trying to deconstruct families? They come from these unhappy families. They come from these deformed families. They come from these damaged families. And they sort of generalize from their own miserable experience to the whole institution of the family. And you add in people writing papers for journals and everything else, and you come up with critical theory of the family. One word on critical theory. So there are critical theories of everything. The only thing you really need to understand about critical theory is, and this is going to sound really simple-minded, but it is accurate. All you need to remember about critical theory is that its job is to criticize and tear down everything. What's going to take its place? Well, you know, after we destroy everything that's terrible here, then something good will take its place. Well, what will it be? We'll know when we get there. This is old Marxist thinking. You work for the revolution, and then what? You get a classless society. Well, what does that look like? You get everybody working for everybody else. Well, what does that look like? Well, every time somebody tries to do it, you end up with a horrible, horrible, murderous society. You have a variety of versions of this. We're going to get to a certain point, and then it's bang, it's all going to change. Some tech people have been talking about what they call the singularity. We get fancier and fancier artificial intelligence stuff, and eventually the machines get so smart they just keep making themselves smarter all by themselves, and eventually then they run everything. Why that should be an appealing idea, I don't know, but it's sort of, you know, sometimes you get bored with life and say, well, that would be exciting, except I'm not, anyway. Now, all of these are fake versions of what we expect. At the resurrection, we will have glorious bodies. We will be with Christ for all eternity. And the Bible says, and there are things that mind hasn't thought of, eye hasn't seen, ear hasn't heard, and we trust Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, that we will be delighted there. Probably the best account that I've seen of this is in the last Narnia book. So if you haven't read the last of the Narnia tales, C.S. Lewis's effort to describe what comes after the resurrection. Now, what replaces the family? Remember, what replaces it is not useless. However, it's not gold. It's bronze. I'm going to name five things. First, where you work. How many of you have heard, oh, we're just like family here? Okay. Now, you know it's not true, because your family can't fire you. Your family can't lay you off. Right? So it's a lie. But it's a lie that helps to encourage your entire life to be focused around your work. I was just reading about China. China's got all of the same social problems, actually, as this country right now. And they're realizing it, and they're trying to do something about it, and instead of pretending they don't exist or saying, hey, look over there, that's the problem. It's the Christians from centuries ago. That's a problem. And in China, the young people say, have children? We work 9 to 9, 6 days a week. We're paying off student debts. We can't afford to buy a place to live. Does this sound familiar? Right. The workplace takes over everything. Do you know who was secretly funding the 1920s feminists in this country? It was the Big Business Association. How come? Well, they look at all these talented women and they want to get their hands on them, get them out of the house, and get them in the office where they can use their talent to make money for the big business. As I'm reading right now about the U.S. economy, I constantly read, oh, woe is us. Women have left the workforce and haven't returned. Actually, no, women have not left the workforce. They left the place where they have to give everything to the boss. And instead, foolish creatures, they're doing all this work for their children and their husbands and sometimes other people, and, you know, who needs that? Now, the government is encouraging things this way. I'll tell you what. If Mrs. Perkins is hired by Mrs. Zegner to do her wash, and Mrs. Zegner pays her, and then Mrs. Zegner does all the wash for Mrs. Perkins, and she pays her, taxes! The government gets a big chunk of that. The government hates work in the family where you're not, no money's exchanging hands. We go back to a real family. Work is there in the real family. At some point, we were coming home from up here, and I was making rough mental calculations for all the money my wife had contributed to the family by cutting my hair and the children's hair, by making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every day, all, you know, forever. So it was a big, big number. And I got all done. She said, "So we can afford to put in new floors in our house, right?"
So we stopped having splinters in feet.
That's right. There was a good reason for it. So I was caught, and we did that. So the workplace. We're family here. Now, the workplace will, most of the time, if they think it's a good idea, they will, without any worry, sell you down the river. How many know the origin of that expression? Okay? In 1808, the United States, according to the Constitution, ended the transatlantic slave trade. And sometimes you think, well, that was the end of the slave trade. That's not true. The slave trade continued in this country until almost the end of the Civil War. And when people in Virginia and Maryland who were producing surplus slaves needed money, they would sell them down the river, i.e. the Mississippi River, to the slave markets in New Orleans. And so that's an expression that we have coming still from that source of families ripped apart for the sake of the workplace. That's the most extreme example. But we've got examples not so thoroughly different. I mean, actually really different, but you've got a husband and wife, they got their house, and suddenly, you know, the worker goes to work, and they say, "We are transferring you to outer perturbia." And you say, "I don't want to go to outer perturbia." "Yeah, well, there's a good business opportunity there, and you got 2 weeks to get there." My kids are in school. They're flexible. My wife has got a lot of friends here. Listen, the purpose of capitalism is to make the most efficient use of labor. Having a bunch of friends does not count. It is not an important issue. The important issue is an opportunity in outer perturbia, and you're the guy who's going to go do it. So the workplace is a fake family. It is often a family that just is destroying and pulling families apart. Then there's a fake family that my guess is not too many of you have had close touch with. Your urban gang. Mm-hmm. I was just reading of an anthropologist's study of urban gangs in Los Angeles some years back. A girl member says, "We are like..." Can you finish it? "Family. We protect each other and we steal for each other." Here's another fake family. The state. In many ways, the state would like to deal with simply a bunch of individual atoms. Having to deal with families is more troublesome. There was, in 2012, a notorious campaign ad put up briefly by Barack Obama entitled The Life of Julia. I urge you to go home and Google The Life of Julia. It's all the ways in which Obama/state have helped Julia through her life, from birth until retirement. What does not appear in Life of Julia? A man. What does appear? Well, one child, taken care of by the state in child care. Have you read articles about how awful it is that mothers are staying home to take care of their children when they're young and not putting them in daycare? It's tragic. Now, why is it tragic? Well, because they want that competent ability there, and the kids get in the way. So, the state, Life of Julia. Here's a fourth fake family. A bunch of friends, usually urban, and they do stuff together. They're not married. They don't have to bother with children. I mean, remember the TV show Friends? And when you look at that, the life looks really fun. Although, when you actually get to know such groups, you discover there's a lot less fun, in fact, because maybe your best friend suddenly betrayed everybody and got married. So, that's a fake family. Now, I'm not against friendship, but if that becomes your main place of life, that is a fake family. Here's the fifth and last fake family. Some religious cults have been fake families. One of the marks of a cult is they take a new recruit and then they say, have nothing to do with your family at all. And they have waxed and waned over American history. The number of cults this country has produced is actually rather astounding. Some of these cults say, furthermore, and there's no point in ever getting married. Now, the good thing about that rule in the cult is, how long does that cult last? Yeah, maybe 100 years at most. But the Shakers did make good furniture. New Harmony produced, actually it owned and gave to Geneva College the land that it started its existence on. Another one of those things. There are other cults I knew of, especially in the 70s and 80s, that would grab people, love bomb them, that was the term, and then say, have nothing to do ever with your family again. That is a fake family. There are other fake families. Sometimes the Masonic Lodge has been a fake family. And some are worse than others. But the ones, in my opinion right now, that are the most pressure on families are the state and the workplace. Third topic. So how do you nurture your family so that everyone thrives in the family, and there's love, and there's loyalty, and there's happiness and kindness in the family? When John and Betsy were young, we spent 3 summers at a primitive cabin up near White Lake. When I say primitive, what I mean is we used an outhouse. We actually had an ice refrigerator. Gretchen cooked on a 3-burner stove from propane, etc. Water off the roof,
kerosene lamps,
and go down the hill and get water from a, and I would cheerfully say to her, actually, we're living at a higher level than a lot of the world, but that didn't. But one thing we had there was a garden of the neighbor down the hill. And let me tell you about the garden. It was ringed with a fence through which they ran an electric current. And if you touched it and you were an animal, you said, I don't want to go in here. If you touched it and you were a little boy, I remember doing this, you said, I need to be more careful. God has put a fence around the family. And if you just ignore the fence, then things fall apart. Fence one, do not commit adultery. Fence two, don't go hungering after your neighbor's wife. And in a world with a household economy, don't go hungering for your neighbor's servants. You know, you poach the servant from somebody else. That doesn't produce happiness. Another commandment. Children, honor your father and mother. That's a commandment. It doesn't say honor your father and mother if they are worthy. It says honor your father and mother. A fourth garden fence. The parents can't make the children work 7 days a week. Only six. Remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy. 6 days you labor. And by the way, it doesn't say husband, you don't have to make your wife work. This is directed to the joint heads of house. And on the Sabbath, don't make your son work, don't make your daughter work, don't send them out to the field. They get a day of rest. Same with your servants. A fifth fence. Did you know the Ten Commandments really focus on family life? A fifth fence. Don't break your marriage vows. If you break your marriage vows, God will not hold you guiltless because you took his name in vain when you took those vows. You take wedding vows as a covenant in the sight of all these witnesses and in the presence of God. And then there's a warning, not directly on the family, but sort of God's ways of dealing with things. When things go really bad, especially with idolatry, how long is a family going to last? 3 or 4 generations. Now, there's another way to nurture the family besides watching out for the fence. For a long time, it was our tradition to go up every Memorial Day and help plant the garden. If you go into the garden and you just throw carrot seeds here and beet seeds here and corn seeds there, you're going to get an awful mess. You need to have order and structure. So most gardens are in rows. But not only that, you have to put the seeds in the right distance apart. So I remember one time I was planting seeds and I wasn't sure I was doing it right. So I said to Dot, that was her name, the neighbor, Dot Mellon, I said, "So, am I putting these in the right way?" And she gave me her typical New England answer. She said, "Well, I mean, you're the educated one." By which I knew I was not doing it right. So, I doubled the distance between the seeds, and she said, "That's better." So you need the structure, and here we go back to Ephesians 5. That's the structure. If a husband does not love his wife the way Christ loved the church, said he's beaten her up, for example, then the structure is broken, and it will not be a happy, flourishing family. Here's a third thing you have to do. How many know what else you have to do with the garden? You have to pull up weeds. When John was 5 and Betsy was 3, we would take them down to the garden and make them help pull weeds. You see, on the farm, you can get work out of the kids really quickly. And neither of them liked pulling weeds. But we said, well, their weeds are here because Adam sinned, and so that's why we have weeds. Well, why did Adam have to do that? Well, here we got the weeds. And we eat from this garden. So since we eat from the garden, it's fair for us to help weed the garden. Now, what weeds do you have to pull out of a marriage all the time? Well, the weed of bitterness, the weed of anger, the weed of shouting, the weed of pride. The book of Proverbs is all full of the horrible trouble wreaked by a wife that just is terrible to live with. If the book were not aimed at a son, you could have similar proverbs to the daughter about husbands. I'm going to add a fourth thing to do. Worship God daily. It is very easy. Choose a place and always do the same place. Choose a time, always do the same time. The Father is in charge if you have an undamaged family. And the Father is in charge, it's his job to be in charge. You sing a psalm, it doesn't matter if it sounds bad, but you'll want to make it sound better if you're singing every day. You read something from the Bible. The traditional way in many pious Protestant families was, and you kneel for prayer, which is what we do. Sometimes you make it a little longer and memorize a catechism or verses. And then, of course, you have to finally nurture the family by letting it disperse. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. The combination of one of our happiest days in our family and one of our most heart-rending days were the days when our children got married. Same thing, both at the same time. But you have to do that. Fathers who hang on to their children after they are long of age and keep trying to direct their lives are going to introduce all kinds of distortions. And I know people, especially those influenced by a fellow named Bill Gothard, who were still calling up their sons at age 25, sons married, 30, 35 every night to do over the phone a checkout with dad. And Bill Gothard said, this is what you should do. That is one of many silly teachings, worse than silly, that has sometimes affected the Christian church on family. So when the child's of age, speaks for himself, and you let him go, and then you pray like crazy. I read an account of a newspaper contest in Britain around the year 1910. What's wrong with England? And people were writing essays and sending them in, and they were publishing it. The same writer whom I quoted this morning, G.K. Chesterton, wrote, "Dear sirs, I am." Yours truly, G.K. Chesterton. They didn't print it. But you know, that's not a bad place to start with. So what's wrong with your family? I am. Which acknowledges the fact that sin infects all of us. Nobody can say with full confidence, I've done what's right, it's her fault. I've done what's right, it's his fault. So you need humility. And then second, you need to thank God for what you have. People sometimes focus all the time on what they don't have. That's foolish. Thank God for what you do have. Next, just reject fake families. I mean, sometimes an office may require, or a construction job may require a lot more time for a little while. Old farm saying, you got to make hay while the sun shines. And I can remember doing hay after the sun went down, we still get taken in the head. But by and large, you need to push back against the business taking over everything. Have friends, but remember they're friends, not family. It's good we have the state, but I get worried every time the state says, we're going to help you with one more family job. I'm reading now that it's outrageous that some people have to take care of their old parents. That should be done by the state with hired labor. And then we're going to get all this labor that, we can let them over the border. But the state takes over one job after another until finally you're just naked before the state. And then you need to keep weeding, keep repenting, maintain the fences, trust in God, and pray Psalm 127, reminding you that if things go well, it's because God has built the house. And it's to Him that you look for the building. Okay. There would have been plenty of time for some singing, John, but...